Hi everyone, and welcome to Filmmaking Life Podcast. I'm your host, Alexander Don, and in this episode, we're going to talk about the importance of gear, more exactly, lighting, cameras, and lenses. And we're going to do that with the help of our friend, Kevin Garrison, which is a big DOP in LA, and he shoots a lot of commercials and a lot of documentaries, and he even got to shoot with the Kardashians. And he knows a lot about gear because he shoots with one of the best cameras in the world, one of the best lenses, lighting, and he knows a lot about it because he works in the soul of Hollywood. Also, we had Kevin on one of our previous episodes where we got to talk about what it means to be a cinematographer and what it means to shoot a documentary with a real tribe and how it is to shoot commercials and what it actually means to live as a cinematographer and work with one of the best people in the industry. I really think that lighting technology has changed so drastically nowadays that has kind of like transformed the old cinematography into being something that it's not necessary anymore. For example, I see a lot of old cinematographers that still go with a truck full of lights on set, and they put thousands of grip things and flags and a lot of stuff like that when you can do it so much more easily. But I get, at some point, it's a little bit about impressing the client or things like that. But what do you think about the evolving technology in lighting? Do you think it's a good thing?
I mean, I think more tools is always better. You know, I get it on both sides. So part of it is, if you could imagine, you know, if I put myself in the perspective of some of the DPs who've been doing this for 30, 40 years and are really, really well established at the top of their game, a lot of times they're using those lights because that's what they're familiar with and that they've used their whole lives, and they know how to get a very specific quality of light using these massive trucks. And at the budgets that they're at, it doesn't really make a difference. You know, it's like they're going for something really specific. So I get that. I obviously have had a very different experience in that LED technology was kind of just sort of taking off as I was coming into cinematography, and I love my LED lights. I'm a big fan of them, but at the same time, there is a certain quality to, for example, tungsten lights, like a tungsten Fresnel. There's a certain quality that it has that it's very difficult to replicate with LEDs, like certain shadow patterns and the way that it, you know, aligns the photons that are coming from a filament that's really hot is a very unique thing. It's the same thing with, for example, an HMI Fresnel, like an 18K HMI Fresnel replicates daylight, you know, in a way that you just can't really get with most other lights, at least at this point. And I think that LED technology inevitably is going to catch up, and then it's going to be great because it won't be as hot. You won't be using as much energy. It'll be safer because there's less electricity flowing into the set, which is a big deal. And I think most gaffers and things would love that. You know, they don't necessarily love the idea of using several megawatts of energy and creating a situation where something could happen. Not that it would if you're going through your paces and keeping your safety etiquette in, but I think it's always better for technology to advance. And then you have the option to use the tools or not. But yeah, I don't find myself, for example, using massive Maxi Brute lights that are pushing 40,000 watts of light through a set. But I do still turn to certain things like a tungsten Fresnel or an 18K HMI to recreate sunlight. Like, those things are still, you know, I think it's important to know how far technology has gotten. You know, and LED technology is not there yet. It's approaching it. It's getting much better. But at this point, there's still certain tools that are hyper useful. There are other ones that are not as useful. You know, there used to be like zip lights that are like these weird kind of soft tungsten lights, which I just don't think there's any use for anymore. Like, there's certain things that are definitely dying off. And the way of the future is invariably going to be LED. Like, there's very little way around that.
Yeah. I think you explained it really nice with the photons. and the heat that comes from the light. And I think that plays a role on selling the fact that the light that's coming through the window or through different parts of the, I don't know, apartment or outside, it's real. So
there's also the convenience factor. Like, you know, the sky panels, the 360s, those massive sky panels. Yeah. Like, if you were to put one of those up on a condor, right, which is a lift, like a big crane lift, if you put one of those up and that's like your moonlight, the fact that you can wirelessly, from an app that Arri makes, change the color temperature and intensity of that light without ever going up there. Like, normally you would have to go up there, you would have to put a screen in front of the light, and then you'd have to change a gel to like tweak it a little bit. But now you could change 10 of them with an iPad and adjust your intensity and brightness and color and all of that. I mean, that saves you so much time on the ground. I mean, that could be, you know, on some productions, that's tens of thousands of dollars that you're saving just in time. You know, it's not uncommon for some productions to be spending more than $10,000 an hour just to be filming, you know, certain sequences and stuff. So if your gaffer can just go, cool, I'm going to bring that down a little bit, you know, and you save yourself 30 minutes, that's $5,000 you've just saved.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we're speaking on another level.
Yeah, but those are, you know, that's a very real thing, because I think anyone progressing in their career is probably going to get to a point where they're spending a whole lot of money. And it's good to know that those things scale up. You know, your time becomes very valuable on bigger productions.
Do you plan your lighting in advance, or do you happen to get to a spot and just figure it out right there?
It depends on the project. I try to preconceive how I'm going to light something, usually on a tech scout. So we'll go out before the shoot, we'll scout the location, and I'll speak with the director and the first AD and kind of figure out how much time we have, and then light according to that, and try to move things around if we need more time in a certain area. So I try to preconceive the lighting as much as possible. But at the same time, remaining flexible when we actually start filming. So once we actually get to the point where we're going to film something, you know, being able to make small changes and tweaks, or, you know, sometimes a lighting set thing, it sounded great, but then you actually get to set and it's just not working. So you have to be able to adjust on the fly. And sometimes that means scrapping all of your lights and starting fresh. And, you know, it's not ideal. And hopefully that's not the case, but you have to be able to do that. And we try to preconceive as much as we can. But like, for example, on Nomad, we don't have any artificial light. So our tech scout, we're looking at where the sun is. We're looking at things that will create, for example, like a natural flag. So if there's a big mountain that's going to block sun, then okay, cool. That's something that can add some shape to the actors and to the landscape. So we're looking at what natural lighting exists in an area, and planning our shots around it, as though, you know, with the same concept as having all of your lighting gear and grip gear, but using what exists naturally in the areas that we're filming in to create those looks.
So it's actually a pre-planning, organizing everything. Well, from one side of the point, it's easier to use natural light, but at the same time, it takes more planning and figuring out where the sun is going to go and stuff like that, right?
It's a good question. I mean, look, the choice to not use any cinema lighting or artificial lights of any kind on Nomad was, one part was creative because it does lend a certain look to the film. But the other side of it was just logistics. You know, we're flying to 25 different countries and taking buses, boats, helicopters, planes, jeeps, you know, anything that you can imagine, any form of transport that exists, we've had to take. And you can't bring lights with you. You know, maybe you could bring a small one, but at that point, it's not really doing the work that you would want it to do. So we decided, look, we're not going to have like one tiny little light that we can, you know, maybe use in some places. We just said we're not using any, and we're going to figure things out using what exists naturally. So in some ways, it's a lot harder because now, you know, you always have the sun, which is great. It's like an 18K HMI light, but it moves all day. So it's never in the same place. So you have to plan on that. And once you can think with that, and you know, I think after about probably 4 weeks, I was like, okay, I can think with it. You start to think with, okay, well, you know, if there's a bunch of dark bushes on this side, that's like putting up a 4 foot or 8 foot flag. Maybe it's a little bit green, but it's darker on that side of the face. Okay, cool. So I'm going to use that. And you start using the things around you to create the looks that you would normally create in a studio. But you're in the middle of the desert in Africa, and you just got to think with, okay, the shadowy side of that dune is going to be my negative fill, and the sunny side of that dune is our key light. So it is a change in the way that you work. But it's also not, because you're applying the same fundamentals of lighting just in a different way. So it's harder in the way that you find that, but it's easier in the way that you're not setting up all the gear, you're not waiting on that. Like, you can shoot 360 degrees all around the actor, so it gives them a lot of freedom of movement. So it's harder in some ways and it's easier in others.
But I think it's easier when you're shooting outdoors with natural light. It's easier to have a great camera. Because this will save a lot from the mistakes that can occur when you're shooting outside. And I really want to ask you, how important is the camera when lighting?
It's, you know, I think most camera systems are pretty capable in this day and age. But there are differences, you know, particularly in color is the biggest area that I notice it. We were shooting on the Arri Alexa Mini LF, one of the prototypes that was first released, or before they released the first batch of them. So we had one of the first 50 that were made from in Germany by Arri. So they shipped it out to us. We got it in Africa, and it's a large format camera, but in the Alexa Mini size body. It's an incredible camera. So I think it matters a lot in that we were able to shoot in some pretty challenging lighting conditions and also in very low light. We were able to rate the camera at 1600 ISO and have a really clean image, which is very unique. So it does matter, and there's a reason why we chose the Mini LF as our camera system. But it is possible with, you know, a RED. It's possible with a GH5. I mean, cameras are pretty incredible these days and have an amazing ability to be graded and colored. But I think in something where you have no option to use lights, you want to give yourself as much room as possible and as much flexibility in post as you possibly can. You know, and in all the tests that I did, for me, it was the Alexa Mini LF was a clear winner. But I've also heard amazing things about the Sony Venice, you know, and I have a lot of friends who swear by that and shoot really low light with that camera. But for me, the color that the Alexa Mini and the Mini LF have is just there's nothing quite like it for me.
Yeah. So why do you think a lot of people use the Arri Alexa? Why do you think this is the standard of Hollywood or the standard of high-end cinematography?
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of amazing cinematographers who swear by RED as well. You know, for example, you know, that's all Michael Bay uses, you know, and Jeff Cronenweth shoots all of his stuff pretty much on RED. And Eric Messerschmitt shot all of Mindhunter on REDs, you know, and those are, like, to me, stunningly visual films. So it's hard to say what the standard is. I think the reason why Arri has inherited this moniker of being the standard of filmmaking is because they're really trusted. And that was one of the big things for me, was I was never concerned at any point that our camera system wouldn't be able to outlast us. So whether it was, you know, insanely hot out in the middle of the desert, like 43 degrees Celsius, you know, out in the desert, just like blazing hot. I was like, well, the camera will survive longer than me, you know. And I think that they have a reputation for having done that over 100 years now, you know, and they really put, like, I've talked to a lot of the engineers at Arri, and Michael Jonas, who created the Mini LF, he's like, you know how long we spent just prototyping different types of scroll wheels on the monitor, like 10 different iterations to make sure that we had the right one. So the fact that they're going to sit there in a room and go, well, you know, this toggle wheel might cost 50 cents, but this one costs a dollar, but it makes a really big difference. Like, they get down to like what type of pin they're using and what the functionality of that pin is that holds this other piece together. And even though it's a little more expensive, it's really important because it creates this, you know, friction in the follow focus. And without that, it could fail on set one day, you know, so they're so involved in the design process that people just trust them, and for good reason, you know. And yes, there's an expense that's created with that, but when you only have one shot at something, like for example, when we shot the solar eclipse, that was 2 minutes and like 38 seconds or something that we had to film something that would not ever really happen again, for us at least. It was like the next solar eclipse is going to be in like 2 years, so we had to get it right in that amount of time. And we're on a 1500 millimeter lens a mile away from our actors filming a celestial phenomenon that is only going to occur once in this place. Like, you don't want to be worried that your card didn't format correctly or that the camera powered off suddenly or any of that. Like, you want that thing to be built as close to a tank as possible. And for us, that, you know, Arri takes the cake on that. And they have a reputation as being reliable for good reason. So I think it comes down to a trust factor. Like, the company that you trust the most is largely going to be the standard, because as a cinematographer, it frees your mind up again for creative. Anytime you're worrying about something logistical is kind of wasted time in a sense. So I think that's why they've really taken the helm as leaders in the industry, and they continue to do so for that reason. Also, the camera creates beautiful images. I mean, yeah. Secondary to that, it's, you know, but does it rely on?
Yeah, I know I work with Sony, and I'm not supposed to say this, but I've seen a lot of crazy highlight recoveries from the Arri Alexa that really blew up my mind. But when it comes to reliability, I think the Sony is also a good camera for that, because I've shot so many festivals with the Sony FS7, and like you said, heat, dust, rain, all that, the camera is still rolling like it's on its first day. So that's a really important thing to have. So especially when, like you said, it's something that happens only once. Like, maybe an artist jumps out of stage, goes into the pit, like shakes hands with everyone. You don't really want to miss that. So yeah, one thing that I really want to talk with you, because I've seen that you also shoot on anamorphic lenses, and I really want to see why so many people freak out when it comes to anamorphic. Why so many people are so desperate about it?
I think it's because it's unique and it lends a really interesting visual style. A lot of people love anamorphic. I shoot a lot of anamorphic for commercial projects, although ironically, as much as I love it for commercial work, I've never used anamorphic lenses for a narrative project. I think it's just kind of maybe the kind of movies that I like and I really look up to, and a lot of the DPs whose work I love and who've influenced me a lot shoot spherically. So I prefer spherical lenses for narrative because they have better close focus. They're usually faster. They're very clean lenses, and I like clean lenses a lot. But I think anamorphic lenses are fun. Like, there's just something really cool about, you know, they're the vintage look, the streaking, the veiling, the blurriness on the edges. Like, it's just a different look. And camera sensors are very clean things. Like, they're very clinically good, and for good reason. They should be very, very competent sensors. But I think that has brought rise to the popularity of anamorphic lenses, because you now have a really strong capturing medium with the camera. So a lot of cinematographers express themselves visually through the lenses now, since we're not choosing a bunch of different film stocks and things like that. Lenses arguably are one of your biggest aesthetic choices. And anamorphic lenses are inherently more rare. Like, they're more difficult to design. They take longer. They're usually more expensive. And there's a lot fewer of them. So there is a difficulty in obtaining certain anamorphic lenses. So, you know, I've shot a few commercials on the Todd AO anamorphic lenses, and it's like as soon as I got them back to the rental house, they were gone for 5 months because Maddie Libertique took them on, you know, two films. So it's like, I can't find those anymore. And that was the only set that looked like that. So there's just like, they're just gone, you know? So, you know, whereas you can find Master Primes at most rental houses. So I think people freak out about it because they do look cool and there's an awesome look to it. But I think it's important to experiment with both. But I actually find myself using spherical for, I mean, maybe I would do an anamorphic for, I don't know, if it was the right story, if it made sense. You know, I think if you're shooting maybe Star Wars, you know, then it makes a little bit more sense and people are kind of used to that look, you know. So I think it just has to be the right project for it. And all of the projects that I've worked on just felt like spherical was the right choice, narratively speaking.
I think it's a lot of personal choice as a creative choice, you know what I mean? And nowadays it's getting more budget friendly. I wouldn't say budget friendly, but it's getting closer to everybody. Now, like you know, now there's Wazen, Siri, more very cheap lenses, and that make people experiment. That this is why, first of all, I'm super excited when I shoot an anamorphic. Nowadays, even the quality is not that compatible with the high lens, but it is just something that made you creative, even if all the technical specs are totally not, you know, usable.
Right, but that's not a, you know, it's not always that the best technical specifications yield the best result, exactly. You know? It's like, there are people who put nets on the back of their spherical lenses, or they rub Vaseline on a filter and put it in front of a lens because it just, it communicates the story better. So I think it's ultimately, it's an exciting tool, and I love the fact that we're seeing new anamorphic lenses being created. So that's what excites me. I mean, I think it's cool that the guys at Atlas are creating anamorphic lenses, and I love seeing that Cook, it looks like they're coming out with some large format anamorphic lenses, which I'm really excited for large format anamorphic. And I think that's going to be the next kind of race amongst all the lens designers. And, you know, so I'm very interested in that. I think it's amazing seeing all the new stuff that comes out.
Yeah. Well, what I want to say is the fact that I also think anamorphic has a marketing purpose to some commercial projects, because if you have anamorphic lenses on set, it means you have a higher budget and it means the commercial will look much better and will look more expensive than the competition's commercial. For example, let's say you have a pizza brand and you shoot that commercial and anamorphic, then not other pizza brands will have the same commercial as you because you have something different. But this thing that is different comes with a cost because it's very expensive to rent anamorphic lenses. What I realized when shooting anamorphic, because I shot a commercial for a jewelry company and we shot with Ari Messer anamorphics, and the lenses are really sharp and don't really have that much character, so you don't really see that much of an anamorphic effect. So what I realized when shooting anamorphic, it was so much harder than shooting with spherical lenses. So I think the time went almost double. The focus was more sensitive. You had to do more takes because the subject went out of focus. You had to do more adjustments. The camera was way heavier. So I think the whole process gets much harder and it takes more time to film with anamorphic. So this is my...
And those are really well-designed anamorphics. Yeah. I mean, like, imagine using... I mean, we had the Todd AOs, which were built in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, I remember we had some, like, floor mats that fell on the dolly and, like, knocked the camera. And we literally had a lens element slide sideways. And it was like, we had to send it in to get repaired because it's just an old lens, you know? There's things aren't engineered the same way. So you're not going to get that issue with a Master Prime.
Yeah.
But there's a trade-off for everything, you know, and it's ultimately, is that trade-off worth it? And is it right for the project? You know, even if all things were the same, there are still certain projects that I would shoot spherically and not anamorphic just because it feels more appropriate to the story. you know, for certain things. There's certain, you know, every project is unique.
Do you think as a cinematographer is important to have your own equipment?
A lot of people would say no. You know, for example, I used to own some of my own equipment, and I still do own some equipment that I use regularly. Like, I prefer to have my own monitor. You know, I have my own small HD monitor. I keep a set of Teradex that I can use to bring onto projects just to have wireless if it's you know, I'm working with friends or something like that. So I keep some of my own gear. I have my own matte boxes because I just really like using them. I use bright tangerine matte boxes because I just like how they're designed. I think they look really cool. So there's certain gear that I have, but I don't think I would say that it's important. I think it's more important when you're starting out in that it allows you to shoot things, you know? So one of the first projects that I ever did, I had my own Red. I had a Scarlett back when it was like the Mysterium X sensor. So it was like one of the first Scarlets. And it was helpful. Like it did get me jobs, and people probably wouldn't want to say that, but it's true. Like there are certain productions that will hire you because you come with a camera when you're starting out. And that's not really as much of a thing now, at this point with the productions that I'm working with, because, you know, we rent all of our stuff, and that's kind of expected. I don't think it's expected that DPs will always have their own gear, but it also depends on the part of the world that you live in, right? So like in the US,
yeah.
It really doesn't matter, but there's other areas like in South America and in Europe where in certain countries, it makes a big difference if you have your own equipment, because you're now one less person that they have to go through. And if it's a production that's coming in, they're like, we need a local DP, and you're saying, I can provide everything that you need. For one thing, you're probably going to rent your camera, and that's an additional income. But it's also less steps for the production to take locally. They don't have to find a production house that's going to find a rental house that's going to, you know, it's fewer steps. So I do think there are certain advantages to having your own equipment, particularly for DPs outside of the United States. I think in Los Angeles, New York, Atlanta, it's less important. Chicago as well. Canada, it's probably not as important to have your own equipment. But those are kind of film hubs. So if you're outside of that, it definitely can make a big difference, especially if you're finding your own clients locally.
Yeah. I think, like you said, it depends on the place you are. Because like for me, there isn't any rental place around me, only at 600 kilometers away. So I have to have everything. So I have lights, I have lenses, I have cameras, I have all the things that I need to shoot, because whenever I get a phone call, I'm ready to go. So I don't have to call and wait 2 days or 3 days for a rental to come here. I can do everything that I want tomorrow if the client needs. But here in, like, for you in US, you can rent a camera like in hours. So
quite literally, my rental house is 10 minutes down the road. So, you know, and it's it's like I could ride my bike there and pick up a camera. So it's, you know, it's, I feel like giving advice to people who are in LA and only see that world, it's like, no, you don't need a camera. And it's like, well, outside of our bubble that exists, it can actually make a big difference. And it could mean, you know, the difference between getting jobs and not getting jobs. So I think it's very important to determine. It's probably as close as rental houses are to you as how unimportant it is to have a camera. Like the further a rental house is, the more important it becomes to have a camera.
So you basically travel a lot, and you face the fact that you have to travel with gear and a lot of equipment. How do you deal with that?
There's some interesting difficulties to traveling with gear, and Nomad's probably the best example, because we were flying every few days to different countries, and all in we had 175 days between shooting and travel that we worked on the film, at least so far. There's still a few days to go. But we had to travel, whether flying or hiking or on a boat, we had to take our entire movie with us on our backs in backpacks or in Pelican cases under planes. So in terms of traveling to other countries, there are certain things like, you know, productions have to deal with carnets. So a carnet is a document that tells you, tells customs that you're bringing all of this gear into the country and you promise to bring it out and not sell any of it without paying taxes inside the country. So, you know, you have to be able to know where every single piece of gear is, and you have to have documented the serial numbers and the value of every single thing so that you could show a customs agent. So that's difficult. So, you know, we spend 2 weeks just making lists of all of our gear.
So obviously we can talk about gear for ages with Kevin because he knows a lot about it. But this episode was actually extracted from one of our talks that went for 2 hours. And it was really crazy because we got through a lot of subjects. But I thought it's the best idea to split that episode into 2 episodes. And you guys can focus more on certain topics like gear and what it means to be a cinematographer, which is the other episode. Also, if you guys enjoyed this episode, please feel free to share it. Also, rate it on podcast because it helps. Leave us some comments regarding your feedbacks, what we can improve, what you guys want to hear more, what is a topic that you guys really want to listen to, and we're going to try to make it happen. Also, if you guys have certain guests that you want us to try and invite on our podcast, I would be really happy to see which one you would prefer because we're going to try to make that happen too. So until next time, don't forget to share it on Instagram. Tell a lot of people about us because you can learn a lot on this podcast. And stay safe, go outside, create a lot of content. And until next time, peace.